Hello and welcome to Stranger Than Fiction, a series of podcasts from Slate and the New America Foundation about the future as seen through the eyes of some of today's best science fiction writers. I'm your host, Tim Wu, and my guest today is Kim Stanley Robinson, author of the Mars Trilogy and 2312, among others. He joins us from his home in Davis, California. Welcome to the podcast, Stan.
Thanks, Tim. It's good to be here.
So, Stan, why don't we start at the beginning and why don't you tell us about how you first got into science fiction as a reader? What interested you about science fiction?
Well, I was an intense reader as a child, and eventually I got to the far end of the fiction section of my library, and at the beyond the Z's was science fiction, and so I just methodically began with Isaac Asimov, and I thought it was tremendous. And I guess I ran into Asimov when I was about 16 or 17, so I was not the classic, you know, 12-year-old science fiction fan. But when I did run into it, I was very enthusiastic. And I had grown up in Southern California and seen the agricultural community get replaced by the urban conurbation that's there now. And so when I ran into science fiction beyond Asimov, it just seemed right to me. It seemed like a good description of what I had seen and experienced myself. So I feel like my encounter with science fiction was running into a kind of a realism for our time.
Right. When you read science fiction back as a teenager, did you have the sense that the future portrayed there was going to happen sometime, or was it a different idea?
No, I don't think science fiction is about prediction per se, although it has done that fairly successfully through its history. But it's what it does, I think, is capture the feeling of the present moment that we're in, the sense of possibility, the sense of rapid change. So it is it's a kind of poetry where the science fiction scenarios are metaphors for how things feel right now. And in Southern California, when I was young, that was a very strong feeling of future shock, of rapid change, of accelerating history and things going off the rails, especially in the late 60s. And so it's that sense of familiarity in science fiction, I think, that is the strongest feeling.
I wonder if you can reflect back from when you started reading science fiction and wonder if you're surprised by the way things have gone, whether the future has ended up different than you might have thought back then when you started reading science fiction.
Well, actually, I think science fiction did a tremendous job starting around 1970 or, say, 65 with the new wave science fiction. Works like John Brunner's Stand on Zanzibar that talk about overpopulation, talk about random violence, and talk about political manipulation and robots fronted by corporations as mainstream politicians. Between Philip K. Dick and the new wave science fiction, I think we have been sort of surfing a wave of futurity, and that in any given moment, our sense of the future is part of that given moment. And science fiction has done a really good job of capturing that feel of what we're headed towards. So I actually think that I could give you a reading list that would include Brunner and Silverberg and Le Guin and Joanna Russ and Samuel Delaney, Gene Wolfe, the writers that were prominent at that time, and many of them still working, have just been great at giving us a sense of what it's going to feel like 10 or 20 or 30 years out.
Did you say robots fronted as politicians?
Yes, that's Philip K. Dick's The Simulacra. After Reagan was elected governor, supported by the big corporations in California, then Philip K. Dick, in his usual prescient way, immediately wrote a book in which the president was a robot being manipulated by corporations behind the scenes, and a very personable robot. And this was in, say, 1965 that he wrote this, so it was well ahead of Reagan's actual presidency.
Well, we're not quite at the robot stage, although I guess you might say a person who takes orders from someone else is like a robot. We haven't actually had a genuine robot, but I take your idea.
Yes, well, we're talking metaphorically here. These images, robots are famously an image of alienated labor, of working people or wage laborers who have no control over their fate. I mean, this is the original invention of the robot as a literary symbol before it became an actual industrial tool.
But do you think there are ways in which the writers in the 60s and 70s of that era of science fiction got it wrong, just completely missed things?
Yes. I mean, this is famous, that the personal computer was not quite predicted, that although I think Dick Tracy's magical wristwatch really was an image. And Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 is really about television taking over the entire room and interacting with you. And that's from 1951. And that sort of is about computers. So by and large, I would say science fiction has been doing an exceptionally good job, and that people who read science fiction regularly are less surprised by the current moment than other people are.
Yeah, I agree with you very much. If I think about it myself, I kind of agree with you with the personal computer and the amazing, some of the decentralization of computing power that has happened wasn't quite predicted. I guess it's science fiction. I was thinking about the movie 2001. Which obviously has a lot of technologies beyond our abilities now, but the computer is obviously one giant computer for the whole ship. And when they go to make phone calls, they go to a little phone booth in which is run by the Bell telephone company, AT&T, and you know, there's some kind of thing like that. So completely missing from that movie is both the personal computer or the cell phone or anything thing like that. So there was sometimes a tendency to assume that centralized power would just become more centralized or the same.
Well, that's right. And I think that you can't really go point by point prediction. Did they get this? Did they get that? It's more the feeling of the time. And I mean, I've made some spectacular mistakes myself. I had the Soviet Union as a going concern 50, 60 years in the future. And I published that novel in 1988. And this kind of thing happens all the time. And actually, the miniaturization involved in computers has been surprising to everybody. Computer experts themselves were saying that the strong computers would be the size of your room and you'd go to a library to use one. And really, science fiction writers have been paying attention to the scientists. So there weren't any scientists in the late 60s saying it's going to get as small as your wristwatch.
Yes, no, I agree with you that it isn't really fair to go point by point. I mean, this isn't weather forecasting or something like that. But it is sort of interesting in my feeling to think like, well, what were you thinking the future was? Are the things that happened technologies that you really just are surprised by that you not only didn't see coming in the sense of you didn't realize how quickly things would get smaller, but just kind of came in a completely unexpected direction?
Well, in that same vein, the internet itself is a shocker, and not predicted. I myself didn't have any sense of it coming. And I have to say, within our lifetimes, there was a lot of talk in the 90s after the Cold War was over that history had basically ended and capitalist Western democracies were going to inevitably conquer all. And that, I think, fell apart on 9/11, and the sense that world history was over fell apart on 9/11, and we're still in the aftershocks of that event. There's any number of things that can throw human society for a loop, but what I noticed, say, in the 1990s was there was intense interest in the Mars program, and in this century, interest in Mars has completely gone away. It's been put off into a more distant future as something that might be interesting later, but isn't on the front burner now.
Yeah, I was going to talk about Mars and bring up the subject. You're the author, obviously, of the famous Mars trilogy. And I wonder whether personally you feel, I mean, having someone who spent so much time thinking about Mars, just feel this sense of disappointment or anger at the congressional and maybe public disinterest in Mars.
No, really, I've never been in a hurry on that project. I've been interested in Mars because it's an interesting place, and we probably have the technical means to get there. But I always was thinking it would be something like Antarctica. So, okay, Antarctica's there. It's really interesting. It's quite beautiful. It's exciting. But nobody is stupendously fascinated by what the scientists down at McMurdo and at the South Pole are doing. It's a small blip on the world history screen. And Mars was going to be and maybe will be something like Antarctica. So it's not salvation for human civilization and not even close to that. It's just interesting science. It could be helpful in managing this planet, and it's interesting in and of itself and would be a grand adventure. So these are not earth-shaking or civilization-shaking concerns. So I thought it made a great novel, and what I wanted was a novel and not a base on Mars.
Right.
So, I mean, I've often been misunderstood on that because it was a long project for me and it's a long novel, but I think it's a good novel. I was really happy while working on it, and I'm proud of it afterwards. But it wasn't a blueprint for a proposal for us going immediately. I do think we will go, but I don't think there's any rush on that.
Right. So it's not as if Jules Verne actually wanted to go 20,000 leagues under the sea. You're saying it's a setting for a novel. Well, I mean, you're certainly someone who's thought a lot about it. What do you think it would actually take to convince us to go to Mars? Or do you think it's just so far off in the distance we can't really know?
I strongly think that it has to come out of a healthy Earth culture, so that really, until we get a handle on the destruction of the biosphere on Earth, until we get a civilization that's in balance with the planet and what the planet can give us, then Mars is irrelevant. So I have no case to make for Mars. My case would be, let's get this civilization into a sustainable relationship with the biosphere that we depend on for our lives. And we haven't done that, and it's a big, big project. It's maybe the project of this century, if we can do it at all. So I guess I would say that Mars is a really tremendous 23rd century project. And if we have done well in the 21st century, then it will surely follow as something that people do. I think the technical means are getting easier and easier. And private firms like the SpaceX project are showing that really competent and robust spacecraft can be built these days and be stronger than ever because of our increasing technological powers.
You know, it's funny, as growing up roughly the same times, I've always sort of felt like, well, of course we're going to go to space and we sort of have to go to space. But when I examine it, I've never really had a good reason why. I just feel like I was brought up, you know, seeing moon launch things and thought, well, and I'm reading a lot of science fiction, I thought, well, you know, how exactly are we going to have all these great stories of traveling from planet to planet through hyperspace if we don't actually go to hyperspace? And I sort of thought that was important. But as you point out, there's not really a clear reason why we need to be there.
Well, I mean, I would make distinctions here. There's no such thing as hyperspace. And so that is just a literary game that we play to try to ignore how big the universe is relative to us.
Right.
We can't get to the stars.
Right.
So that was always a fantasy.
Right.
But we can get to our solar system is the neighborhood. And you could say, well, look, we're living in space right now. We're on the surface of a planet. We happen to have a protective atmosphere. We're really lucky that way. We wouldn't be here without it. But we are in space rolling around the sun. And the sun's neighborhood is our neighborhood. It was studying the atmosphere of Venus that allowed us to understand that we were burning up our own, making that hole in the ozone layer, which we have for the time successfully counteracted. So it was actually planetary science that allowed us to see that this planet was in trouble because of our industrial processes. So there is use to space science, and I think it's great to think about humans in space, which is to say on the moon, in low Earth orbit, and going to Mars, going to the asteroids. That's all the neighborhood, that's all realistic, and it's all interesting and useful and beautiful. But then when you get off into warp drive and hyperspace and the universe, then you're just playing a fantasy game that, unfortunately, it kind of confuses all these issues together. And it's possible to throw out the baby with the bathwater and say that since we can't get to the stars, we might as well not go to the moons of Jupiter. Well, it doesn't follow. The moons of Jupiter would be fantastically great to be on. And we can get to them, too, which is important.
I do notice in your work that you tend to stick to what is actually relatively plausible, given a few decades of scientific advance. In other words, you don't have people entering deep sleep for, you know, hundreds of years to get to other stars, or of course hyperspace, as I described earlier. I take it that's a conscious choice.
Yes, I think what's most interesting is what is possible. So I'm not a fantasy writer and I don't do space opera. But I will say this, if I have an idea for a story that requires those things and it seems to me like it'd make a good story, then the story takes precedence and I'll do it. So that in my novel, Galileo's Dream, is a time travel story. And time travel is about as impossible as faster than light travel, maybe even more so. But I wanted it for the story. So I studied up quantum entanglement and, you know, non-locality and made up a time travel excuse that I could live with because I wanted time travel. And if I wanted us to be, you know, across the other side of the galaxy, maybe I would play that game too if the story seemed to justify it.
Some people have described your books as, and you yourself have described your books as having an effort to describe what a utopia would look like, and perhaps maybe you're trying to show us something in some of your books.
Well, I'm often described as a utopian writer, and I think that's right. In different ways, I've tried to put a utopian inflection into my work, which is to say that I've described positive histories or futures that have happened where it hasn't been apocalypse, it hasn't been disaster, dystopia, repression, but instead has been more positive in one way or another. And in some novels, it's slightly more positive. In other novels, it's a full-on utopia where things have gone right to the maximum that seemed realistic to me at the time. And there are very few writers that are doing that repeatedly. Some writers will do a one-off where they'll try a utopia and realize that it's technically hard and it's hard to keep it interesting, et cetera, the usual objections are made. But I think that it makes for interesting stories to tell. And so I've tried it again and again. And ultimately, I guess it is a distinguishing mark. It's one of the things that I'm known for.
Yeah, I'm reminded a little bit of Huxley, who wrote Brave New World as a dystopia, obviously, but then later in life wrote Island as a utopia. And as if they were sort of trying to show us that it was possible to use science to make a better world. I wanted to ask whether you'd already mentioned climate change and other environmental issues, but I was wondering if there are other kind of tech or science issues that you follow carefully and are concerned about.
Well, I love to follow the news in archaeology. I just think that's the most fascinating of sciences, and we're beginning to get a better and better grip on humanity's past. And a combination of physical archaeology and then DNA studies that are tracking back the human genome through both male and female lines to find out where people came from and how they moved around. And that, there's a similar process in linguistics where we can track languages around in the same way. And so we're getting a much stronger sense of our past and also finding remarkable things. This Göbekli in southern Turkey, where there's a kind of complex of Stonehenges made by a hunter-gatherer society, it blasts all previous conceptions of what humans were like 10 and 15,000 years ago.
It strikes me that you have an interest, we might say, in the bigger issues. You're not exactly day-to-day politics, but the last several million or billion years of human or geological history.
Yes, and I think a lot of our local politics is simply theater and bad theater, soap opera, and concocted to sell media, to get people to look at media and get intensely interested in what's the minutiae of these elections, which so often are between two positions that can barely be distinguished from each other, and yet there's huge anger and supposedly. So I think a lot of that is concocted, and I try to stay out of it as much as an American can, given that the results are important. And I acknowledge the results are important, but I think the process is a farce and a way of getting people to pay attention to media. So I try to save my attention to media to stuff that's just more interesting and more substantial.
Right.
And because we all only have a limited amount of time, and I just think the sciences are more entertaining, for one thing, and then more substantial also.
Well, that's a great note to end on. And Stan, it's been a terrific pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Tim, and thank you.
I'd like to thank our producer, Tori Brosh, our engineer, Chris Wade, and Andres Martinez of the New America Foundation. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Andy Bowers. I'm Tim Wu, and thanks for listening.